And please be with Jason as he shares today. May he listen to your prompting and your spirit. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
And I love Esther. Love the book, love the story, love the way the story rolls. It's an amazing journey. And I'd like to take you on that journey this morning. Esther is in. Esther comes into Xerxes' life in the third year of his reign. And while in Esther's time, her people were in captivity, a bunch of Israelites had actually gone back to Israel in 536 BC with Zerubbabel, but actually most of the Jews had stayed in Babylon and Persia. And Esther's story is one where Xerxes had made a bunch of kind of poor decisions. One was he was embarrassed by his wife after partying for 6 months, which might be a good reason for his wife to embarrass him. But he was embarrassed by his wife, and so he divorced the Queen Vashti. And then he lost a war with Greece, and then a few more bad decisions, such as sleeping with his brother's wife. And we get to the book of Esther, and we find out that he starts to miss Vashti. Oh, Vashti, Vashti. And these personal attendants notice that he's a bit sad. So they make a suggestion to him. Maybe you need to have a new queen. It'd been roughly 4 years since he'd divorced Vashti, and maybe you need to have a new queen. So their suggestion, well, obviously they were men, because their suggestion was you can find a queen not because she's wise, not because she has poise or maturity or she comes from a good family, but this is the criteria by which you can find a queen. Let the search be made for a beautiful young virgin for the king. So they said, let's go out into all the 127 provinces that you rule over and we will find young women who please the king most. And then from that, we will pick a queen. The king thinks this is a great idea. And so it off it goes out to the provinces for a beauty contest. And one young lady who was drafted into the contest, and I say drafted because she was a prisoner. She was kind of like property of the king already. I'm sure other people offered, but she was drafted into the contest, and her name was Esther. She had grown up with her cousin Mordecai, because her father and mother had died. And other people might have willingly gone into the beauty contest, but she went there probably about 15 years of age. She would have been a virgin, she would have been not married, and she was a Jew. And Mordecai said to her, do not let anyone know that you're a Jew, because he thought Jews were under persecution. So don't let anyone know that you're a Jew. Esther, she gets through the prelims into the final round, and all these finalists go before the king, and then they get some impressive beauty treatments. Just wondering, women, if you're going to go out on a date, how long would you take to prepare? 45 minutes? 30 minutes? An hour? Anybody ever spent more time preparing than the date went for? Well, look at the prep time that Esther went through to get ready for the king. Before a young woman's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women. 6 months with oil of myrrh and six with perfumes and cosmetics. A whole year of preparation to look beautiful enough to go before the king. And then they all get their turn, all these finalists, of going before the king. And now, I'm not going to be prudish about it. This is not a normal beauty contest where you have to, you know, have good conversation and fundraise enough money and probably look beautiful as well. These women went from the virgins' quarters, spent a night with the king, Xerxes, and returned to the concubines' quarters. And then Esther was chosen out of all these women. And it says of Esther that King Xerxes loved Esther more than the other women. How special. He's got concubines, he's got a harem, he's got all these other women, but out of all the other women, I love you the most, Esther. Esther was his favourite. So he put a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Cousin Mordecai, he kept a lookout for young Esther. 15 or 16, she would have been 16 or so by now. Any 16-year-olds ready to be married off? She was looked after by her cousin Mordecai, and what he did is he got a job at the king's gate, so the entranceway into the palace. And one day while he was working there, he overheard two of the king's officers talking together, and they were conspiring to assassinate Xerxes. So Mordecai told Esther, and Esther reported it to Xerxes and gave credit to Mordecai. And then they wrote that down, as was their way, that when they investigated the report and found that it was true, the two were hanged on gallows. And all of this became recorded in the book of annals in the presence of the king. For some reason, Xerxes honoured a evil man. His name was, I'm going to call him Haman. I'm pretty sure I've pronounced it poorly. He was an Agite, and he made him prime minister. Now, when the Jews tell this story, they get the children to hiss and boo. So let's just hear that. Haman. All right? So when you hear his name, you can hiss or boo. But that's what they do. They say, he's a baddie. And what he did is he made all the royal officials at the king's gate kneel down and pay honour to him because he was a very important person. But of course, there was one person who refused to kneel down. I don't know why. His name was Mordecai. He didn't do it. He might not have done it because he didn't think that Haman was any good and didn't deserve to be knelt down to. He might have done it because he was a Jew and thought that I shouldn't honour anybody apart from God. Word of Mordecai's behaviour got back to Haman, and Haman was mad. And he was so mad, he decided he hated not just Mordecai, he hated all of Mordecai's people, all the Jews in the empire. Pretty nasty man. Now, every year, at the beginning of the year, the king would take some dice, basically, and would cast them to see which day of the year would be his lucky day. And the lots or the dice were called pur, and they were cast, and they fell on the 13th day of the 12th month of the year. And so what Haman did is he had an idea. He went to the king, and he unleashed his plan to kill all the Jews, and he said, there's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the people of all the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from those of all other peoples and who do not obey the king's laws. It's not in your king's interest to tolerate them. So let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I'll put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. So basically he's saying, if you want to be lucky on the day that you've cast, then there's only one thing you should do. Get rid of the people who are making it hard to have a great kingdom. Get rid of these Jews. So the king heard that and thought that was terrific advice. Gets out his signet ring, gives a little stamp of approval on it. He says, keep your money. I think you should do with these people as you please. Dispatches were sent out by couriers all over the provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on the single day, the 13th day, the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. Esther is back in the palace, unaware of all that's going on, but she hears, as you heard, that Mordecai was weeping and fasting and dressed in sackcloth. So Mordecai gets his word to her and says, can you please intercede with the king? You've got his ear, or more. You've got his ear. Why don't you intercede with the king? And so she sends back a message saying, you know, if I go to the king without being summoned, there is a law which says unless he puts out his golden scepter, I'll be put to death. Here's the climax of the story. Esther has good reason to fear going to see the king. Anyone who went without being summoned was seen as doing treason. And some writers say that this law was enforced by having a squad of people with axes surrounding the king, ready to hack the unbidden guest down. Well, Esther, for whatever reason, knows that she can't just go do that. Plus, the king had not seen her for 30 days. And so she might have wondered how much influence she still had with him. Well, Mordecai was pretty blunt about it. On her hesitation, he says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come into your royal position, treasury, for such a time as this." Rescue and deliverance will come. Mordecai has no question on that. But if you stay silent, Esther, Mordecai says that you will not be part of it. Who knows? You may have come to this royal position for such a time as this. Ever thought about that phrase? It's a well-known phrase. If you've ever heard of Esther, you definitely know this verse. It's like the main verse. And you think about all that's happened to Esther. She's grown up as a Jewish slave. She's been taken from her home. She's been placed into a palace life. She's now owned by a pagan powerful king for his pleasure, and she's subject to his mercy. To be put into this position is not a good thing. Who knows? Maybe you've been put into that position for a reason. There are so many sad and terrible things in Esther's life that it's with real courage that they don't complain about it. Instead, what they do is they see that their sadness and their tragedy are opportunities to be used by God. So Esther is actually more than good looks. Xerxes chose beauty, but he got a bit of steel as well. And she wasn't afraid to fight for what was right. So Esther sends back the reply to Mordecai. "Go gather all the Jews who are in Susa, the capital city, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days or night or day, and I and my attendants will fast as you do. And when this is done, I'll go to the king, even though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So until this point, Esther's been carried along by everything. She's been quite passive. She's done what she was told at every turn. Now it's her turn. It's time for her to act. So she says, "Get all the Jews together, get them to fast for me, I'm going to act." And armed with courage, and she puts on her royal robes, and she goes to the king, to his inner court, and waits for Xerxes to see her. What would have gone through her mind? Will the king accept me? Is it going to be life or death? Will I get hacked up into little pieces by all these men with axes? Short interlude at this point. Just a short break. What do you think is going to happen? Well, the king saw her, and mercifully he reached out his scepter. She's going to live. Xerxes says to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you even to the half of my kingdom." Now that's king talk, right? What do you want? I'm in a good mood today. If Esther had said to him, "Well, actually, what I'm after is the north half of your kingdom," I'm pretty sure his mood would have changed. This is more on the level of, you know, "Hey, darling, would you like to choose the Netflix movie tonight?" Esther knew that it wasn't time to blurt out this request. "I'd like you, Xerxes, to revoke the unalterable law of the Medes and the Persians and to execute Haman, your prime minister. Please." She doesn't do that. Instead, she wisely says, "I'm hosting a banquet, and I'd like for you and Haman to come." So he agrees, and the banquet is great. The king had a great time, and he was drinking, and he's feeling good. So again, he said to his queen, What is your petition? It shall be granted to you, even to half my kingdom. And again, Esther shows her shrewd wisdom. She says, this is my petition and request. If I've won the king's favour, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, in other words, it's a really long-winded way of saying, please say yes to what I'm about to say, then let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and then I'll do as the king has said. In other words, she's put on a banquet to set up the king so he's in a happy mood, so then she can have another banquet to actually say what she wants. She is shrewd. Her beauty is more than skin deep. So Haman, oh, come on people, Haman, yeah, Jewish kids can do a better job than you, come on. Right, Haman, he enjoyed that first banquet. And on the way home, everyone's bowing and to him on the right and the left. But then he sees one person that's not bowing. It's Mordecai, and that ruins his day. So he gets home and he mopes around the house and he tells his wife, basically, I've got all these things going for me. I'm like number two in power. I'm tremendously wealthy. And I've just come from a private banquet with the king and the queen, and they've invited me back tomorrow. But all this does me no good as long as I see that dog Jew, Mordecai, not bowing to me. So his wife lovingly listens and gives him a sweet suggestion. Maybe what you need to do is build a gallows, Haman, and impale Mordecai on it. And that really brightened his mood. He felt much better after that. So he instructs the workers to build a 25-meter-high pole so that they can impale Mordecai on it, and they get to work and labour all night on the project. Just nearby, the king couldn't sleep, probably because of all that racket. So he wakes his servants up, and he orders them to read to him a book that he thought, this will definitely get me back to sleep, The Annals of the King. And for some reason, they open up the book and they read the chapter. They're told of the time that Mordecai saved the king from assassination. And Xerxes said, did we ever do anything for Mordecai that honours him for this brave act? And they said, no, king, we didn't. Well, I better do something about that. Otherwise, it's a blot in my honour. By this time, it's early in the morning, so the king says, who's around the palace? And it turns out Haman's there. Bright and early, he's whistling, he's chirpy, he's eager to ask for permission to impale Mordecai on this 25-meter pole that he's set up. So he's brought in, and the king says to him, I need to pick your brains. What shall be done for the man to whom the king wishes to honour? Haman thinks to himself, well, who else would the king want to honour apart from me? He must mean me. So I better make this request really good. Haman said to the king, if you want to honour someone, then let him wear one of your robes and crowns, sit him on one of your horses, and have someone parade him through the streets saying, this is how someone whom the king honours is treated. And the king said, that's a great idea. I like it, and I want to honour Mordecai. And you can be the one that goes in front of the horse and tells everyone, this is the one that this is how the king treats someone who he wants to honour. So that night, after spending the whole day out in the sun, in front of the horse, yelling at the top of his voice about Mordecai and how great he is Esther's second banquet. And you can imagine Haman. He's just sitting there, picking at his food. He's got a headache, didn't hydrate for the whole day. And he's just been had a day of being forced to honour his sworn enemy. But at least the king had a good banquet. He had a good time. And once again he said to Esther, Esther, you've been fattening me up long enough. What's your request? Even to half the kingdom. He lacks originality, I know. So Esther, reclining on the couch, says with amazing wisdom and boldness, that the king, as she says to the king, that she and her people are about to be destroyed. The king says, "What? By whom?" And then she shows her daring and her intestinal fortitude, because she doesn't even pause. She looks straight at Haman and launches with, "He is your adversary and enemy, this vile Haman." The king, he gets up in rage and he stomps and he heads out on the balcony and he's just fuming. And Haman knows he's in serious trouble, so he throws himself down on the couch where Esther is and he's begging her for mercy. And the king walks back in and sees that Haman, he's now on the couch with his wife, and he says, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" And at this point, the eunuchs read the room and they back up and they grab the little towel and they put it over the top of Haman's face, because they know Xerxes never wants to see his face again. Haman is a goner. And so Xerxes thinks, "What am I going to do with this traitor?" And the eunuchs make a really helpful suggestion. "Hey, Xerxes, there's a 25-meter pole outside Haman's house that he made for Mordecai." And the king says, "Let's impale him on it." Haman's estate's given to Queen Esther. Mordecai takes Haman's place as number two leader in the kingdom. And while the law that said that the Jews were going to be killed could not be overturned, Xerxes consented to have another law written, which gave them the right to defend themselves, and they did. No Jew was hurt on the 13th day of the 12th month, and to this day, Jews still celebrate this event in a festival in February or March, which they call Purim, based on the word for lot, the Persian word for lot, which is pure. Now, interestingly enough, my Iranian friends tell me that this is they still celebrate this event too. And Esther is Hadassah is quite well loved in their nation. I find that very fascinating. You can all applaud at the end of the story. It's an amazing story. I've skipped a few details, but not many. And it's well worth, you could do Esther's story in one easy reading. I want to make a couple of observations about Esther's life. God's not mentioned in the book even once, in the book of Esther. So in many ways, Esther's life feels a lot like our life. When you read the Bible, you feel like, "Oh wow, look at all those miracles and those signs and wonders. Why doesn't that happen with us today?" Well, in Esther's time, there weren't miracles, signs and wonders. And it seemed to the Jews that God had disappeared. Their temple had been destroyed. The people were scattered in Israel. The prophets seemed silent. Well, actually, they were talking. They just weren't listening to them. And didn't seem that God was at work. So they could have thought God has deserted his people. God's in hiding. Rabbi Shmuley, he says this, that it would be possible to read Esther and fail to notice God's involvement in the story. You could read the whole book and think there wasn't anything about God. I wonder, did you see anything about God in the story today? Has God deserted his people? It would also be possible for Esther to read her own story and feel like God was absent in it. She was an orphan, she was in exile, she was a slave, she was abducted, she was persecuted, she's embedded in politics and intrigue, she was left to make her own decisions. Where's God in all this? It would be easy for Esther to conclude that God was not involved. But she doesn't. She responds to Mordecai's challenge for such a time as this by doing what? By calling a fast. And a fast isn't like a diet challenge. A fast is to set aside eating so that you may seek God and pray. And she says, "We need you, the people of God, and I and my attendants are going to not eat for 3 days so that we might call upon God. He's hidden, but he's not absent, nor is he powerless." God actually does play a major role in the book of Esther, even though his name is not on the list of characters. He has no lines. Chuck Swindoll puts it this way: even when God is invisible, He's always invincible. Esther, she's chosen queen over all the other 126 beautiful candidates. Mordecai discovers the plot to kill the king. The casting of the lots at the start of the year was for late in the year, in about a month's time, funny enough, for late in the year, which gave Mordecai and Esther and all the Jews time to act. Mordecai's conviction, when he says, if you don't act, Esther, it does not change the outcome. I know that we will be saved. His conviction that God would rescue the Jews is implicit in what he said. Her call to fast, the king's acceptance that Esther could enter his throne room unsummoned, the fact that he granted her request, the fact that the king was unable to sleep, and when they opened the book, it came to Mordecai's deed of kindness. Even though God is hidden, he's still present. Even when God is invisible, he's always invincible. And even though God is hidden, and this is so important, I think, Esther acts. She has 3 days of fasting. We have no idea whether she gets a word from God. In fact, we should presume she does not. She'd already made a decision, remember? She had 3 days of fasting. She doesn't put out a fleece. She doesn't wait for a divine voice. She doesn't see a burning bush. She has no signs. She has no more signs than the one that she has, that we've fasted and I've made a decision. I am going, and if I perish, I perish. That's simple, practical faith. Too many of us are very pious. We seek God to do the obvious. Esther thinks, I'm in the situation. I must be God's person. I'm going to act. Why is it so hard for Christians to do what is right and obvious and couch it in spiritual language? Maybe the Lord doesn't have this. Maybe it's not God's will. Maybe I don't have the right signs. You don't need flipping signs. You need to do what is right. And Esther does it. And because she does what is right, not knowing whether God is in it, it rescues the Jews. She's a woman who has, despite her background, stunning confidence, courage, selflessness. She's drop-dead gorgeous, and she's made of high tensile, toughened steel. Amazing. What have you learned from Esther? Here's one reflection that I have. You can be like Esther. Not in the sense that you could be a nobody who becomes a royal somebody and changes history, although, who knows? An Australian has gone from being an Australian to being married to the Danish royalty, haven't they? But you could be like Esther in the sense that your sadness or your struggle or your loss or your pain can be God's opportunity for freedom for others. You can be like Esther in making a choice to not let all the things that you suffer with drag you down and make you useless for God's purposes. You can be like Esther and seek and plead with God to change our world. And then you can get on and with faith and courage do what you know to be right, regardless. You can be like Esther in knowing that you are God's person for whatever comes your way. And when you act like that, you can be like Esther and see that God actually uses you for relief and deliverance. And that even when God is invisible, he's still invincible. You can be like Esther. I want to invite Miranda up as she brings this series to a close.